Hi, I'm Britton.
And I'm Nick.
I am Bonsu, and this is Chalk It Up, a podcast that celebrates all things Sussex through stories and conversations with inspiring local people.
In this episode, we talk with Brighton-based community worker Jason Savin. We spoke with Jason about his youth work on the Whitehawk Estate in Brighton, young people's mental health, and his time with Albion in the Community's Reboot programme, where he mentored young people affected by gangs. We hope you enjoy listening.
Tell us about your earlier life in Sussex.
So I was born in Brighton in 1974, and lived in Brighton for a bit, and always kind of in the kind of area along the seafront, along to Chichester, kind of went to college in Chichester, lived in Shoreham and Southwick for quite a long time. Played a lot of football. So if there's anybody out there listening that's played football in Sussex, they probably have met me, or I've probably kicked them at some point. I'm a nice guy, but on the football pitch, my wife always said if she ever met me on the football pitch, then we wouldn't be where we are today, because I like to get involved. But it keeps me going, keeps the energy up. I play for lots and lots of teams. I've done a lot of, probably for the last 30 years, I've put most of my work into youth work and family work and supporting communities in Sussex. So from kind of Whitehawk, Molescombe, across to Worthing Children's Homes in Shoreham, and YMCAs and things like that.
I mean, what sticks to your mind most about your experiences working with families, youths in Sussex?
Okay, so yeah, there's so much, so many come to mind. And I guess when you get an opportunity to do this, you have an opportunity to reflect on it, because, yeah, you don't always get that opportunity. We're so busy and stuff like that. But I think if I was to say what started the passion for working with families and with young people, really was I was a neighbourhood warden in Whitehawk and Molescombe. And, you know, a lot of people knew those areas. And before I went to work there, all I'd done is work in factories and played football. And I just remember someone, I was going to be best man at their wedding, and the bride said to me beforehand, we're building up, and we were just spent time together, and she said, you know what, Jay, you can do more in your life. And I was like, and you know what, it just takes one person to say that at the right time. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, you can help people, you know, you're so good at what you're doing, you're calm and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so yeah, I was like, yeah, maybe I can. So I applied to the police force and to the neighbourhood wardens at the same time, sent the applications off. And I always remember I got the application for the neighbourhood warden job to be part of the community safety team in Whitehawk and Molescombe. I got the interview. I went out to the interview. I bagged it. On the bus back, they called me and said, we want you straight away. And I was like buzzing, and I got home, and on the map was the application form for the police force. I was like, yeah, it says it all, mate. You're too slow. So that was it. And working there, you know, people would say to me, what are you doing? It's like a war zone. It's this, it's that. There's so much to say about it. But once I was in there and I got to know people, they, you know, everyone just wanted to do better. Everyone wanted to move forward in their lives. Everybody just needed someone to talk to about what moving forward was for them. And I suppose my biggest success, I would say, working there was we were at the community safety team meeting that we had every week, and there was a group of young lads that were causing issues down near the shops in Whitehawk, and shopkeepers had complained about them. They weren't going to school. Some people were complaining about them. So I said, look, I'll just go and talk to them. I'll go and have a chat. So I went down there. Now, this was, 23 years ago? So I was like 25, something like that. My maths is awful. I went down and I said, oh, lads, how's it going? And they gave me a bit of grief at first, saying I was a police officer. I was like, I'm not a police officer. I'm just here to work in the community. What are you up to? What are you doing? And they just said, well, we just hang out. We've got nothing to do. So I was like, come on, let's go and play football. And obviously they took the mickey out of me, going, you're too old to play football, old man. So I said, let's do it. Come on, let's go. So we all went up to there's a place called the Crew Club up there that does a lot of work for the community. I'll always shout out the Crew Club because I think they do boxing and stuff. They've grown over the years now. A lot of young people gone through there, but they were quite small at that time, but they let me use their facilities. We all played football, and then we started, from that, we grew to the White Hawk Young Men's Group. A lot of those boys that were there weren't attending school, and our targets were trying to get some of them to actually get into school and to go through their GCSEs. But yeah, we just set up a group. We always agreed that at the beginning of each group they prepared toast and fruit, teas and coffees and juice. We always did half what they wanted, half what we wanted, and the half that we did was always stuff about well-being, about looking forward in their lives, what moving forward was for them. And the half that they did was something stupid like going to play football or even hide and seek. I mean, these were 14, 15-year-old boys that people thought were causing issues on the streets, but actually they just wanted to be kids and hang out and play hide and seek and play football and play tag. And we were so surprised because they wanted to do these things that actually, if I went to a group of lads in the street and say, oh, do you want to play tag? They'd laugh at me, you know, but yeah, that was really good. Working with these young people and seeing them flourish. And we got something like 75% of the kids we worked with, the boys we worked with, went back into school. Some did some classes, some didn't, but they did their GCSEs and they got something, you know. That for me was good.
In your view, when you have worked with young people, what do you find that, you know, 25 years ago, what young people was getting into and how you could get them to a place that, you know, you've talked about giving them some social skills, talk about giving them some sort of purpose, and the successes that you had then and now, where do you see difference in terms of young, you know, I'll probably say young people, or youth at the moment, what challenges do you feel that they are facing now as compared to before?
Well, funny enough, I was listening to your podcast that went out with David Ford, was it? He was talking about listening to music, wasn't it? And the inspiration of something. And he really had that kind of sense of inspiration of that's what he wanted to do. And I think when I worked with young people in the past, they really struggled with that sense of what they wanted to do. So I don't know, when I was working with young people in the past, it was just about being a good man. I mean, mainly I've worked with young men and boys. I have worked with females, but, you know, obviously when it comes down to giving advice and stuff like that, I wouldn't say I'm the right person. I can give advice about life and stuff, but when it comes to boys and how to act and behave, talking about toxic masculinity and all those different things that we have talked about, you know, I feel I've got a hold on that. So, back in the day, it was about how to be a good, decent young man and how to grow up to look good in your community, how to have people respect you. So it was quite general back in the day. I think what came out, and I think something came out a little while ago, I'm not going to try and say exactly what it was, but they're actually bringing careers back into primary school, because I believe they said that they reckon kids nowadays, when they get to the age of 7, they're starting to understand a bit more about what they want to do moving forward. Right. And I think that's because of social media. I think that's because they've got more exposure to things that they like. So they're going on things like TikTok and, well, mainly TikTok, probably Facebook. I mean, I don't know them all, Snapchat, all of them. There's the algorithms. So as soon as they like something, they start following one or two of them, they get loads of them come back. And all of a sudden their minds are entrenched with all this information on football. My son, he loves football and he loves cats. Okay? That's what he watches on TikTok. They come through all the time, cats and dogs and football. So what happens then is he now loves that and he goes in that direction. I think that's the positive of social media that is different now. Obviously, there's some negatives with that as well.
So, Jason, you know, in terms of what you've seen worked in the past, 23 years is a really long time ago. And now, what do you think are similarities in terms of challenges that young people are facing? And what do you seem to view as a challenge for youth workers, community workers, to really bring young people back into the levels that we feel will make them have purpose and will put them, in your own words, in the right way? What do you make out of that?
Well, I would say the similarities of challenges would be young people knowing the direction they want to go in. It's about, you know, whose role is it to support the young people to know which direction to go. Generally, usually, if you've got a family background of granddad and dad and cousins all doing the same thing, it's easier for a young person to look up to that and say, I want to be like them and I want to do this. So certain family backgrounds will support this with some people. The youth work, a lot of the youth work I've done in the past, they've been people who've lived in certain areas or lived with families that have done local jobs, and that's absolutely fine, of course. But then some young people want say, well, I want to do my own thing, but what is that thing? So I guess the challenge could be to try and inspire. We need to try and inspire the young people. And the challenge is, who does that? I find now parents just seem so busy. Everyone's so busy. Everyone's stressing and worrying about money. A lot of people worrying about money, about health, about mental health, well-being, about looking after themselves. Work isn't... No job seems to be safe in this day and age. At certain levels, people are always worried about their jobs. You know, this is obviously countrywide, not just Sussex. And people are worried about mortgages going up, things like this. So people are busy, and sometimes we forget to... the challenges are to make sure we're inspiring our young people to find a direction to move forward on. In the old days, I would say it was more generic. You know, we working with young people, we had a young men's group. We would try to get them to do their GCSEs back in the day. I know it's all changed now. The exam system and all that kind of stuff. But it was about doing that. But then it was get them into boxing, get them into the Army Cadets or the Cubs or the Scouts, you know, get them into groups. I think that still applies now. And I think still now there's a lot that could be said for young boys in particular, still getting into something where you need some discipline, you know, and some direction, and have a friendship group and have a social group. So football, rugby, all sports, even the solo sports like boxing and swimming and things like that, there's a group, there's a dynamic that can support them moving forward. I suppose it's the young people that don't have those things in place. And then with the young people that I've worked with, I would say the families that don't have the money to get the kids into those sports or into those activities, those kids sometimes get left behind. And that's what happened before, back in the day, because they weren't really sure. You know, they didn't have a group of friends they'd meet up with every week and a leader that was saying, right, look after yourselves, eat healthy, be healthy. You know, we're going to have an event on Saturday. We're going to come and do this activity together. And during the week, make sure you sleep well and eat well and blah, blah, blah. And look up to this person that was the leader of that group, which was generally a decent human being that was teaching these young boys how to grow up. Because we all know young boys, well, kids generally don't listen to their dads, yeah? I don't know, maybe that's just me. But when I talk to other parents, I say, oh my gosh, you know, I'm trying to help him with this or this, but he doesn't listen to me. And the dads go, yeah, you're his dad. Of course he doesn't listen to you. What are you talking about? So they say, well, what you've got to do is go to the coach and say, I want him to try and do a bit of that and then go in that direction. So, yeah, it's about having that communication as well.
So you think that, you know, in your view, how are we doing in Sussex when it comes to this now? Are we having enough, you know, sort of, you use the word decent, you know, people dedicating themselves, volunteering or supporting young people? Are there enough, you know, out there? You know, how do we promote that?
I think we could always do more. I'm never going to say it's enough, because there's always going to be some young people that are missed just because of dynamics of what we do or where we do it or the activities. But there's a lot going on. I mean, in my world, I can only obviously talk about my world and my family and my son, it's a lot about football. So I've worked with Albion in the community in the past. Worked with them for just under 2 years. I first went in there on a project called the Reboot Project, which was working with young people that were on the cusp of being in gangs, so in county lines and drugs and alcohol and getting into fights and stuff like that. That was mainly based in Eastbourne area, some in other areas, but a lot over in Eastbourne. There's a few issues of different areas in Eastbourne, which I didn't even know about. There's kind of, you got the town gang and the Shinewater gang and the other areas, different areas start building up. So yeah, I got invited to go to Aberdeen Community, and I started working in schools and with kids there and kind of talking to them, having sessions with them about how they can make changes in their lives and how they're in charge or in control of what their next move is. So it would be things about what you think and what you do and your actions and your behavior, and how we can control these before things start going wrong. So that was what my job was when I first started. And after 6 months, I went into the schools department. So Albion Community was sending a lot of coaches and workers into schools to work with young people. So that's what I did. I was curriculum lead for PSHE, Personal Social Health Education. So I would go into schools and we'd talk about resilience, well-being, confidence, mental health, physical health, masculinity, and all those different LGBT stuff, you know, all those things. And that was really helpful. A lot of young people didn't know a lot of stuff, and it was about opening up conversations, having chats with people, talking, allowing them to ask questions. And this is the thing, I think we've got to allow young people to ask as many questions as possible. And from that, we've got to be honest as well. Not just say what we want them to hear. We've got to be honest about what we believe and how we can keep them safe so they can make the right decisions as they get older.
And in your view, I mean, obviously being a teenage dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think parents are finding this? Who young people, the challenges, you know, the young people are exposed to so much. They could see information very, very quickly. Like mm-hmm. you've talked about, social media makes it very clear. Of, you know, they could see people doing well or appearing to do well on social media. They could see, you know, people, and that can actually, you know, sort of affect their mental health. So in your view, how are parents doing in this sector, in this particular moment, and how have you dealt with it? And is there anything that anyone can actually pick from?
Well, I would say parents are struggling a lot. I would say a lot of parents I talk to are finding it very difficult to keep up with things that are coming on social media. They haven't got time to go on it themselves, so they try to keep things open and talk to kids, but they think they know what they're getting up to, but they're talking to their friends, and other friends are watching other things, and they're sharing things with each other. I think parents are struggling a lot. When I was going into schools, what I really like to do is just open up these conversations to see what people think. Last year, there was a lot of talk about Andrew Tate.
Yeah.
So that came up quite a lot. And I would almost invite that to come up because I wanted people to talk about it. And there'd be certain people that would be like, oh, yeah, my mum hates that guy. And blah, blah, blah. But they didn't know why. So there were some parents that were talking about it because it was in the news, because they had time to talk to their kids. And that was great that the conversation was there. But I was there to actually say, well, why? Well, what's going on? What's happening? Because then there were some kids that went quiet because actually somebody had said he was an okay guy. So I came in and said, look, I mean, this is what's going on. This is what people are saying about this guy. This is how he's behaving around females. You know, let's have a talk about this. So I was very lucky, I feel, because I work in youth clubs as well, but I was working in schools, to have time and exposure to be around young people to just bring that conversation out and just say, what's going on with this guy? What do we think's right about him and what do we think's wrong? And how would you act? How do you think we should be acting as young men? And stuff like this. I don't know if parents have those times. So for me, as a young teenage... Well, I'm not young, but as a teenage parent, yeah, we have a thing, like, when we have dinner and my son is with me, we have open dialogue. We always say this is a time to talk. So he asks us questions and stuff. So I think that's a thing that we need to do. We talk about the difference between old, going back in the time, and what we do now. I hope, I'd like to think more parents will make sure they have time around the table, have food and sit around and go, right, let's talk. Not allow mobile phones at the table, because kids can go on mobile phones any time, and talk about what's going on. I don't know, teenagers sometimes, because they have so much exposure on social media, there's probably some things that they're like, oh, don't, my mum, my dad won't understand this, this or this. So they just don't want to talk about it and it goes quiet. Yeah.
That is challenging for any parent because you cannot keep up. I mean, obviously, I've got young ones, and it's difficult when you are unable to keep up. I remember my daughter was telling me, Dad, do you know what trending means? You know, So parents are finding difficult. So, where do you think? What do you think that maybe parents should do in your sort of youth work? What you think, how can they relate to their kids in a way?
I think what I do is I actually start following, I start going on them myself. So I go on the social media, I follow it, you know. It's scary though what it does though. I mean, for example, with TikTok, the way it's set up with the algorithm, and if you're, I think I was saying before, if there's stuff you like, they'll just keep showing you videos of stuff you like. They know what you like. You know, the algorithm does that. So what they do is, I don't know if you guys have seen TikTok or use it, but what they do is a video will come up and the dopamine will hit you like that, because it's like, wow, that's something I really like. And it's really cool. If you like football, it's a great goal. They'll take on a load of people and they'll score top bins and everyone will cheer. And you go, huh. And then all of a sudden, it will stop, but it'll go into another one. And then they'll show you it again. And you'll go, huh, like this. And, you know, you see kids, they will be on that for hours because they keep getting that hit. That good hit of something exciting again, something exciting again. So the challenge is, how do we kind of break that hit or try to give them something more exciting or as exciting that they might want to get into? So for me, I think I have always said, I really worry if my boy doesn't come out and play football with me.
Mm.
You know, I really worry if we say, look, we're going to go and do, I don't know, go bowling, or we're going to do go for a walk on the beach, but we'll get some donuts or we'll get some crepes. You know, live in Seaford, there's a crepe hut down the road, we'll go and do that. You know, and sometimes he'll be a bit, oh, I can't bother to get up. But it's not because he doesn't want to get away from the screen. It's because he's just a teenager, just doesn't want to get up. But most of the time he'll get up, or he will come and play football, or we will go and do something else. If a film comes out, he'll want to go and watch a film. So he's still got that drive to go up and do that. I think what parents have got to do is keep giving options for other things to do. Find out what they like, keep being interested in what they like, and keep asking them. Just ask them. So what is it you're into? What could we do together? What, you know, swimming, playing football, going for walks, whatever. There's so many things that I'm sure that if you talk to your kids, you can find in common that you can both do. And you just got to find that thing and keep doing it every week, at least do it once or twice. Because if not, they'll just be in their rooms constantly.
Do you have an opinion on when it's a good age for a child to have a mobile phone? Because my son's not at that age yet, but I know that it's on the horizon. And I'm quite interested to, because it's a worry, yeah. And you talk about the dopamine hits of the doom scrolling, and I think that as adults we find it hard enough managing social media. So, you know, how do you equip children with that? You almost need to, they almost need to go on a course to sort of, or they need some sort of training before they get exposure to this. And then this sort of question that comes after that, that's related to that, is about bullying, I guess, identity on social media, and if you've had any experience dealing with situations of bullying with young people, and how have you handled it?
Okay, so the first question, actually, you know, only seems like yesterday that my boy, we got him a phone, but it was... I think it's about giving them a purpose for that phone. So don't just get to an age where you go, here you go, you've got a mobile phone, and let them learn for themselves. Because then they'll go and ask their friends, and they will ask their friends at some point anyway. They're going to go down that way. But it's got to be a purpose of why they're having that phone. So for my lad, he'd finished primary and he was just going to go to secondary. So he goes to Lewis Priory, and he had to walk from the top of Lewis down to the bottom. So his mum and I started setting up some kind of training during the summer holidays between primary school and him going to Lewis Priory secondary, of him walking on his own, because we'd always driven him in and stuff. So all of a sudden he's walking on his own. So all of a sudden he feels a lot more mature, a lot older. He's walking on his own down. We met him at certain places to make sure he's crossing the road properly and stuff like that. But with that, we said, right, okay, so we want to make sure you're okay. So this is what a phone is for. There's a purpose. The phone is to contact us if there's any issues. The phone is to check on, you know, bus times or check on this. And we showed him how to do these things. The other thing as well is you can set up, remember, parental controls. So before they get that phone, it's about learning how you can have parental controls about what they can put on that phone. So, for example, my son, even now at the age of 14, we trust him and stuff like that, but he can't download anything onto his phone without his mum getting an email saying, your son's trying to download this. She needs to accept that. I remember we went off to London and we went to a gaming place and we had to download an app just to get into the gaming place. And then we were like, damn, we can't get on there. And I was phoning his mum going, let him get on there. And she was busy working or something. And I was like, And so that was really annoying at that time. But there was a purpose. He knew what the purpose was. It was to keep him safe. It was also certain things, not to track him in a way of so we know where you are. If something goes wrong, we can come and get to you. So he sees what that phone is. That phone is something to keep him safe, to help him, to make contact. You know, if, for example, he's sick and or something and he can't get home and he wants to go to Granny and Granddad's, they live in High Street, so he can just phone them up and say, are you in? Yep, you can go in there. He now has a massive purpose for this phone. He knows what it's there for. The difficult thing is, obviously, once he sees other children, other young people, that they're on all these social media stuff. But you know what? I think kids learn well, and we can keep the boundaries. Don't be scared of saying, no, it's okay. That's just how we do it. And I know Johnny, Fred and Jack have all got TikTok at the age of 12 and 13, but that's okay. That's what their parents do. It doesn't mean that's what we have to do. And they might be upset for a bit, but they'll get over it. They'll be okay. Mm. It's okay to say, no, that's not okay. Or it's okay to tell them the truth as well. Be honest. I think that's a big thing. Be honest. So when they say, well, why can't I have what Jack and John have got? Say, because Jack and John, I don't think should have that. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. I'm your dad. Well, that's your mum, and we don't believe that you should have that right now. But I tell you what, give it a couple of years, prove us how mature you are and how much we can trust you, and we will look at that, okay? Mm. So we're not saying never, we're just saying right now we don't think it's right for you. This phone is to keep you safe. So that's the first question, I think. Bullying happens a lot. I mean, and this is once again quite a difficult thing, but we have to be honest and we have to understand how dangerous the phones are. I think we've all seen, everyone must have seen, I think it happened on Facebook a lot of the time, where people in certain countries would take a picture and then say, tell us where you're from, where you are, where you've seen this picture. They take a picture and they send it out to the world. And then they see how many thousands of people see it. And they ask people to share it. I don't know if you've seen this. It was trending quite a lot, I think, about 5 years ago. Because someone did it in a school in England. It went all over the world. It went to Australia. It went to Africa. It went to all the continents. Because everyone was sharing it with everybody. And what they were trying to teach them was the power of the internet. And the power of once you put a picture out there, it's out there. You've got no control over that picture. So very early on, you have to say to kids about privacy. You have to teach them about that. And the reason I'm saying that is because I know there's children, young people that are being allowed to get involved in things like TikTok and Facebook, and they're dancing or they're singing. And I've mainly worked with boys, and boys, before their voices are broken, they're singing Disney songs and they're loving life. And the parents go, oh, isn't this cool? Oh, look, he's got his own little channel now. Everyone's going to like him because you think he's sweet and he's cute. But at some point, he's going to go to secondary school and that's still out there. And there has been bullying where kids have found that and gone, oi, oi, look who I found.
Mm.
And his world, you know, that's his childhood. That's that poor boy as a kid just enjoying himself, just being himself. We used to have home cinema videos, yeah, where you just, you know, I'm talking 20 years ago, you did it, recorded on a camcorder and you played it on a VHS and that was
I think that was 40 years
ago. Oh, was it 40? Sorry, I'm trying to feel better. Okay. So 40 years ago, it was just every Christmas you pull it out and go, oh, there's John. Oh, yeah, don't embarrass me in front of the cousin and the auntie and whatever. And we laugh at that. But now you don't do that. Now we put it on a social media site and it's out there. Mm. And these kids grow up and kids are bullying kids because of what they're doing when they were like 8 or something. The other side of it is, you know, you got parents showing things.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden they're doing it as kids or 20 something, getting really drunk. Or I think there was that whole thing about, I don't want to upset anyone, but there was a whole fish face, people called it fish face, where girls were getting Botox lips, really big, blah, blah, blah. And people were saying, what are you going to do when you're a grandparent? Because they were taking pictures and showing themselves like this. Now, back in the day, those pictures would be gone, but now they're always there. And then at some point, you're going to be a grandparent.
Yeah.
And someone's going to pull those pictures up and be like, oh. So be honest from the start and remind kids about, remind kids where these pictures might go and tell them that once you put it out there, it's gonna stay out there. We got to look after their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
There is things you can do. As parents, you can set that privacy so only certain people can see it. And that's what we've got to do early. When you get that phone at some point for your child, I think what you've got to do is check it up, go on the internet. There's information out there that will tell you as a parent what privacy settings you can have, what you can set up, what can only be seen by just close friends or family. So if they want to do things online and show themselves, it doesn't go to the whole world. It just goes to certain people.
Mm.
And then you keep that safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant advice on that. I just sort of move it to how you deal with it. So let's say you are a parent and you got into, you know, your child is being bullied.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we all have had experiences as we grew up. Is there any experiences that you've had, any experiences that you've had to deal with, you know, being a teenage dad, you know, dealing with bullying, dealing with any form of uncomfortable situations that you feel that will help others to deal with, how you deal with it and how it help others to deal with?
First thing that comes to mind, as working in schools, and I've done this in youth work as well, is a lot of the time I've worked with the bully. So it's about, normally a bully, I would say, has low self-esteem themselves. So they're going out, they're finding that to bully others, pick on them, make them feel smaller, makes them feel bigger, makes them feel better. So young people that I've worked with in the past, I know what they're getting up to. It's about sitting down and talking to them and saying, you know, how do you think you're seen? How do you think you're seen by your peers? How would you like to be seen? Getting them to reflect on themselves and talking about how they could be. So it's about empowering them, making them feel stronger. Say, look, you could be a leader. But how could you be a leader? Not by force, by supporting others, by showing what strength is, by being a positive role model, by actually you could go out there and you could punch all these people or you could say all these things to hurt people, but wouldn't it be great if you talked to them and they understood that you're the big, strong I am, but you don't use that. So I believe there's that film, Schindler's List, where there's the German officer who is, he has a house in the middle of loads of workers, and he sees these workers working around, and some of them are a bit lazy for his liking, so he just comes out and shoots them. And Oskar Schindler comes up and is talking to him, and obviously he tries to, he's actually trying to help the poor guy out there, and he talks to the German officer and says, do you know what, once you shoot them, you've let them go, you've finished them off, but how about them understanding the power that you've got without you using it? You know, how about you don't shoot them and they just realize you still have that strength? And so next time when he goes to shoot someone, he looks at them, they look at him, and then he pulls his gun away. But then the guy just moves on. But he knows he's there. It's not about flashing your strength or pushing people around to say, I am strong and I can beat you up anytime you want to be. But it's about talking to that bully and saying, we all know what you've got. We all know that you're strong or you're clever or you're faster than others. But actually, you can help inspire. You can help support other people. And you can become a bit of a hero and a leader. So it's about changing their mentality. The other side of it is working. I've worked with a lot of young people that have been bullied in schools, that are low on self-esteem, they're low on confidence, they're low on direction of where they are in this world. And for me, that just takes time working with these young people. It's about looking at what their interests are, what they're into, and then helping them to visualize and believe that they have a purpose. Because a lot of the time, if you're being bullied and you continue to be bullied and you allow yourself to be bullied, then you become a target. And I see young people in schools, and they're not usually bullied by one person. There's usually people think, oh, they're a bit of a pushover, and it's because they're quite low in confidence. So it's about chatting to them, saying, you have got a purpose, there's something you're interested in, you're passionate about. You know, back in the day, 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think we talked about it, we'd send them to boxing or to judo or karate, where it was controlled discipline, but they got strength and they knew they could look after themselves. It wasn't because we needed them to turn around and start punching everybody. It was because they had that confidence to walk with their head held high. When somebody confronted them, they were able to say, mate, no, this isn't happening today. And actually, this, most of the time, if there's a bully there, like I say, they're low on self-esteem, they're actually, you tell them no, some of them will go, oh, mate, whatever. And they'll be walking off because they're a bit like, oh, that person's got something about them. So I think we've got to help the people that are bullied and support them to get their confidence up, get their self-esteem up, get them to be passionate about something, and also get them to realise they are worth it. They're worth fighting for themselves, you know. Then a lot of the times, obviously, I would work with the schools, working with schools, working with teachers, getting them to keep an eye on things, the way they would sit certain children with certain people in class, because nowadays kids sit in the same places in school. I don't know about you guys, but we could choose wherever we wanted to sit. I think a lot of schools, you sit in that they're told where to sit now. And I think that's to stop that from happening. I know that's in my son's school. He doesn't just get to choose. Because I think what happened is you had cliques. You had certain people would just sit next to the same people and the same people would get shoved to the back. So they mix it up a bit. So it's about talking to, talk to the schools, talk to the teachers, and find out what's going on. And communication is key. Communicate to the person that's getting bullied, help them up. Communicate to the bully, we know what you're doing, you don't need to do this. And communicate to all other adults that are around that young person or around the young people. I know it's hard sometimes to communicate with the parents of the bully because they don't want to believe it sometimes. Or you find there's some bullying behaviour going on there and maybe that's where it's learnt behaviour. But have that conversation anyway. Somebody has to have those difficult conversations.
Excellent. I mean, just bringing it to you and obviously spending all your life in Sussex, how do you find Sussex? Have you, you know, what are some of the most interesting places that you feel that you've really enjoyed? You know, what if someone was coming to Sussex and say, hey, Jace, I'm coming here. I mean, what are your views about Sussex? What are the areas? What are the places you go to? You feel more safe? You feel nostalgic? You know, what?
Funny enough, today I went to Brighton with my son and his girlfriend, and my wife, and we were around the Seven Dials area, Brighton, and we went to St. Answell Gardens. I don't know if you know it, a lovely little public gardens that was just, and do you know what, it was just a lovely place. And I think there's others in Sussex. So you go in, there's a cafe right in the middle. There's tennis courts. There's a fish pond in the middle. There's playground. There's an area that just goes round and there's just a grass area. But then when we lived in Brighton, just off the Dials, when we lived there, we used to go there, and we talked about this today. My son and I used to spend something like 5-6 hours in that park because we'd go there really early, go in the playground before the kids got there. He loved it. He'd play in the playground. Then once all the kids turned up, it'd get a bit crowded. We'd go to the cafe and get a bit of brunch, have that brunch. And then we'd go off to the fish pond and probably chuck some bread in. I don't know if that was good for the fish. Don't do that if you're listening. I don't know what you should be feeding fish.
I don't think you're supposed to feed ducks with bread anymore.
No, no.
We used to, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly. No, not anymore.
You're not allowed.
We went there today actually. And if anyone, the Friends of St. Answell Gardens, which I know I used to be a member of, please go and look at the fish pond. It is overgrown. It needs to be looked after. But we used to go there and feed fish. Sorry about that. And we used to watch him play tennis. And my son remembers going round and round and round where the grass area is over to the side. And they used to have like Shakespeare plays on there, like open air. It's just. Used to be a place where he just remembers it. Mm. Obviously, the beaches. There's beaches in Sussex, which I know it's very stony. and they're not like the Cornish beaches that my wife's from, which are lovely. But there's just an atmosphere, I think. I think all the beaches have their own kind of atmosphere. We're in Seaford now. We like to get a crepe and go on the beach and just chill there. There's enough space. It's just chilled. You know, I grew up opposite Kingston Beach in Shoreham. So for me, I used to go out and play wall ball against the lighthouse. I spent hours over there, left foot, right foot, all that. And then every time the lifeboat flares went up, we bolt across the road and go and watch the lifeboat be launched. So yeah, that was all reminiscent for me. That's all, kind of my little areas around
Did you grow up in Brighton?
No, so I was born in Brighton, but I mainly grew up in Shoreham and Southwick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We went along to there, so that's our main.
It's a greater Brighton area, isn't it? Shoreham. I mean, it's all connected, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's all the BN postcode. Yeah, But yeah, that's quite long.
What was it like growing up in Shoreham?
Well, It was different. I mean, obviously, we're on a podcast, so no one would particularly know that I'm black. But being the only black person in Shoreham, Southwick, and then when I went to school in Goring, along towards Worthing, that was very interesting.
So really, you were the only
black person. The only black guy there for years. It seems like a long time. I remember, so I went to St. Peter's School in Shoreham as my primary school. And then my mum thought I was a bit of a troublemaker. So instead of letting me go to Cardinal Newman, where most of my friends were going to in Brighton, she sent me out to Chatsmore because we were Catholic. I had to go to one of those two in Goring. So I went out there and just made new friends. I wasn't a troublemaker at all. She was just very strict. and I made lots of friends out there. But I remember it took till I got to the third or fourth year in Chatsmore High School. And I remember the day someone came around and went, Jay. And I was like, whoa. There's other black guys here. I was like, what? Shut up, man.
No, yeah.
I remember what field I was on. It was so strange. I was like, what are you talking about? It sounds like something from Different Strokes here, doesn't it? We're talking about Willis. But I was just like, what? And I remember feeling, I remember feeling weird.
Did you feel threatened slightly? But
I think I did a bit.
I guess you'd had, that was your thing, yeah?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I completely owned that.
Now there's another.
Yeah, there's others there. Yeah. And this guy, I remember the guy whose name was David, and, you know, and his, oh, I can't remember, his sister was a bit older. I'm really sorry that I can't remember your name, because I saw her years afterwards, and I think we spoke and said hello, but this was years afterwards. But, yeah. These two guys turned up, and I just remember that being very weird for me, very strange. The funny thing is, growing up, I probably, my survival technique wasn't the right thing to do. My survival technique was to make jokes about myself before other people did.
Right.
So I would make probably inappropriate racist jokes about myself, about my colour, probably about my culture. And people used to laugh and then go, oh, he's all right, actually, I like him, he's funny, and move on and not make those jokes. So, you know, I was always quite really well liked. I was always got on quite well with people. I was always funny. And I wonder if other black people coming in, I was like, oh, now I've got to behave. You know, I can't make these jokes because it's not just me. Growing up and getting older now, and then having a son and having a daughter, and realising, and being a youth worker and working with young people very early on, at some age, I realised that it was the wrong thing to do. So now I'm trying to teach young people of colour and everybody about how we communicate, and that it's not okay to be like that. I remember, actually, when I was playing football, because I've played football for so many teams, and I was playing football for a team in Worthing Wanderers it was, and I remember I used to make quite a few jokes about certain things. I don't know, it might be if someone was down injured, I'd run off and grab the water, and then I'd make a joke about me being the water boy carrying the water from somewhere, and everyone would laugh, and certain jokes that I made that were really, really not great. But then I got to a point where I realised this was wrong, and I had a very, very good friend. Luckily, I had a very good friend who I'd gone for a beer with, and I said to him, mate, what I'm doing is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this, and nobody else should be doing this. Mm. And he said, Jay, do you want me to have a word with the lads? I said, yes, I do, actually. Mm. So he did. He just went to them and going, lads, Jay's realised, don't do it. And everybody, to be fair, everybody in the team, apart from one guy, everybody else was like, yeah, that's fine. It stopped. Mm. So any kind of negative stuff that was being said, any bad things that were being said, any racist things that were being said, it was all coming from me. I was given the okay, the green light. But then as soon as I said, no, that's not okay, pretty much everyone was like, yeah.
They sound like good mates then.
Yeah, they were good mates. But they were good people. They were good humans, you know. Yeah. They were, and that's what it's about. It's about communicating what's right and what's wrong. And then saying, yeah, that's not okay.
Perhaps they were looking to you for cues 100%. About how they should behave. And I guess if you were feeding them that, they were going along with it.
100%,
then,
yeah.
So when you said, actually, they're like, yeah, no, okay.
Yeah. And then, funny enough, you saying about that reminds me, and me talking about this, reminds me that sometimes, as I got older, I'd meet people that would say certain things. I'd go, I'm not sure that's okay that you can be saying that. And you go, but I've got a black mate who says that kind of thing all the time. And I think, yeah. I used to be that black mate. Yeah. And I used to say these things all the time. And then what I'm doing is I'm allowing you to say these things. I'm giving those cues that are saying it's okay to make these jokes.
Yeah.
But no, it's not okay. It's not okay to make that joke at me. And I shouldn't be making jokes that you can't make with other people. I shouldn't be saying, oh, only make those jokes around me because I'm okay with it. I should be, no, it's not okay. And actually, as humans, everything we do, say, and the way we act is just experience, isn't it? It's just experience. It's just how we've lived. It might be learnt behavior from parents or people around us, but we just experience something. So if I come in acting in the wrong way as a black person and I'm the first or the only or the main person they've met and I'm acting that way, they're going to think that's okay because that's their experience. I need experience not to be like that. I need to do my bit as well.
And you realised that, didn't you?
Yes, I realised
that. And I guess you were young. Like I guess originally when it started, like you say, you're the only black person in the school.
Yeah.
And you were a kid.
Yeah.
And you did what you had to do, I guess, to survive. I mean, school is tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
And even if you don't stick out. So... you know, no one can blame you for it, I think. But it's great to see that actually there was a time as you grew up that you realised that self-realisation actually, I shouldn't be doing that. That's growing up, isn't it, I guess? Those moments.
Yeah, exactly. It's about moments. It's about having good friends around you and it's about having that communication. And then self-awareness. Now when I work with young men in youth work and in schools, I talk about the three A's. I talk about attitude, awareness, and authenticity. Your attitude, when you walk into the room, what's your attitude? How does it change how other people act? How does your attitude change the environment that you've just walked into? Does it change the environment? Then have the awareness of how that changes or what you're doing or how you're treating others or how it makes others treat you because of what you're doing. But then keep authentic to yourself as well. So how do you actually feel about that? What do you want to say? So you don't just change yourself because of who you're around all the time. You've got to have a bit of... a structure around yourself about a strong inner belief of who you are, what you are, what you want to be. And that's your authentic self. And then move forward with that. I hope that makes sense.
Certainly. And do you think that maybe having children made you think more about that because you'd wanted to prepare them in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think having my son, you know, he's 14 now. So, yeah, I mean, I started thinking about it beforehand, but having him really made me think even more about it. And other opportunities where certain things were going wrong. And I had an opportunity to support people. So there was somebody who's quite close to me who was going to school in Lewis as well. And she was basically the only girl of colour going to a school very close to us. I can't remember what it's called. But it's in Lewis. And her mum was struggling a bit because there was a bit of racism going on there. So there was talk about possibly taking her out and all these kind of things. But we spoke to the school and we said, you know, this is what's going on. We want some support. What are you going to do? So it's cool. We'll deal with it. We'll deal with it. And they tried to deal with it by inviting someone to come in and talk about racial awareness and stuff like that. And unfortunately, the person came in, stood in front of a whole year group and said, when you look around, there's many different colours and many different faces. And this girl was the only person of colour in her whole year group. So she went from just kind of receiving abuse from a small group of boys to all of a sudden everybody kind of in the year group looking at her going, oh yeah, she's the only one. I didn't really realise that. Mm. And she felt even worse. And we heard about this. So I felt like I wanted to do something. So I actually said, right, listen, don't take her out. I'm going to go in. I'm going to volunteer. What we need to do is have more exposure. We need to have more black people. Because remember, I said, it's all about experiences. And actually, some of these people haven't seen black people before. So they don't know how to act. And parents maybe aren't having those conversations about these things. So I went into that school. I worked at a summer fair, or spring fair it was, and I remember I was working on the candy floss, and it had been pointed out to me, this small group of like three boys that were causing these issues. And as the boys walked past, one of them had a Man United bag on his back. And so as they walked past, I went, oh mate, excuse me, you've got a dirty mark on your bag. He's like, what? I was, you've got a dirty mark. I think you've dropped it in some dog mess. He was like, what? He took his bag off and all his mates were looking. Going, what's going on? What's going on? And then he looked. I was like, oh, no, it's Man United. That's dirty, man. And they were like, oh, you've been done by that old man. It's like, you know, and they were just laughing. And then they came over and said, who are you? So I told him who I am. And, well, not particularly who I was, but I told him who I was with. And anyway, that moved on. And about a week later, the girl came up to me and she was like, you know, she didn't correct them, but they come up and apparently they said, oh, we met your dad last week. He's really cool. And they actually became friends. Like, that's actually true. They had a bit of respect for her. They saw her in a different light and they'd spoken to somebody else of colour. And it was just because they experienced something else. Hmm. So I think, and I feel like in Sussex, there are a lot of organisations that are trying to make companies more diverse. They are trying. And by doing that, even I'm laughing because there's certain companies I've worked for where they'll do the annual report and there'll be pictures, so I'll get asked to come and be in the pictures. Or they'll do a calendar or something, so I get asked to be in there. Which, there's the negative side is, oh, it's always me, isn't it? I've got to be the token guy. But the positive side is they're trying to show that they're diverse because they're trying to attract more people. And the more we have that experience of more diversity in all the companies and organisations, in the schools, in the, you know, in all these kind of different establishments, the more diversity we have, the more experience people will have and the better it will be.
Mm, okay. Yeah. No, it sounds good. I mean, what you're saying is diversity is a conscious effort.
Yes.
It shouldn't necessarily be something that an organisation, you know, basically get given. They have to make the effort to do that. And also, people of colour should make the effort to be available, to be inclusive, rather than actually, you know, sort of maybe being behind the scenes. So if we want to support diversity in Sussex, as Sussex is not blessed with a lot of diversity as compared to somewhere like London, you know, I have similar experiences. I'm moving to Bexhill of all places, you know, maybe probably 15, 16, maybe 17 years ago, and I could count on my fingers how many, you know, sort of people of colour or diverse background were living there, and you know, moved from Bexhill to Lewes, and exactly the same. But obviously, you know, what I can tell from all my friend groups, my the school my kids goes to, people are very, very positive and they are willing to learn. But if there isn't enough to learn, if there isn't enough people to be inclusive or people of diverse background to be volunteering and being inclusive and supporting, then it will be difficult for anyone to educate themselves a lot more or support diversity, because they may do it wrong. Like you experience when someone came in and all of a sudden they were in an aspect in on the field and they realize that they've said the wrong thing, and that young person felt less inclusive than the idea. So I think I take from what you're saying, you know, that people of diverse background should also make conscious effort to be more inclusive. So people who are not more aware of diversity sometimes could also learn and take the right cue in terms of what to do. Because, I mean, my wife is white English, and if she goes to Ghana, where I'm from originally, well, finds you, she sometimes could be the only white person in a particular restaurant or maybe in an environment, and she sticks out. You know, so there's not much you could do about that. But the idea is you know, what I can see is obviously the more you know, people can talk about it as a very sensitive subject. It's only sensitive if in my view there is no understanding of the underlying factor of what is sensitive. It's sensitive if I don't understand it. You know, and I don't know what to say, if it's right or wrong. And you growing up in Sussex, I mean, I think I've lived in Sussex now for maybe 22 years, almost half of my life. I can understand, you know, that I usually be the only black person in my friend's group or in most places that I am. You know, I have not come across any kind of racism as such in that sort of environment. But I can understand that people who do not understand diversity have not had the experience of diversity.
And it's funny you said, because you said about people worrying about what to say, and you get some people that don't say anything at all then, and so then there's not conversation being had and there's questions not being asked. I said earlier, you know, young people should be asking questions all the time, but even as adults we should continue to ask questions, look for answers and learn and experience, keep experiencing. But then sometimes some people, you know, I don't feel like in Sussex, I don't feel like I've been very lucky that I don't feel like I've had any real harsh racism aimed at me. What I feel like I've had is gentle racism. I don't know. I'm just going to call it that, because there's certain things where I know some people in a different mindset might go, well, that's not right. So, for example, when my wife and I went to see Black Panther. We went to see Black Panther at the depot in Lewis. It was lovely. I'd lived there for 6 years and went to see Black Panther. I got my red wine. I sat in the back seats with a nice big, put my red wine in there. I was chilled out. And then next to me was this older lady, and I saw her just no. I saw her look, man. She looked over to her shoulder, and I felt it. I knew. I was like, "Oh my gosh, something's gonna happen. She's gonna talk to me." And I saw her. She looked round at her husband, and she said something. And then they both looked. I was like, "Oh mate, do they think I was in this? What is going on? Why? What is
him? It's him."
So it was exactly. So I and my wife, she's from Cornwall. She's never been racist, you know, whatever. But she always says, oh, "I didn't realise that this was happening. I didn't realise people would talk to you like that. I didn't know this was a thing, because she's never been like this. So I said, oi, oi, they're going to say something. Anyway, the lady was like, oh, did you come from far? Oh, sorry. No.
That's another way to phrase the question, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I said to her, I said, no. I live in Lewis. Oh, do you? Yes. I live in Lewis. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, brilliant. So that was it. I thought that was it. I looked back at her husband. So I looked at my wife, said, there's going to be more. And seriously, honestly, I'm not making it up. She went back to her. So where were you before Lewis? I was like, I was born in Brighton. And I think I said it in a certain way. I don't know how I said it, but she was quite upset with me. And that's it. She didn't talk to me for the rest of it.
Yeah.
But it was like, I don't know how to take... I mean, you know, I feel like I want to take her for a coffee and have a chat and, yeah, you know, enlighten her. Mm-hmm. But it's about her experience in Lewis has always been white.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that she watched Black Panther, she was watching Black Panther, yes, and she'd read all the gumph on it, yeah, and that she was sat next to probably the first black person she'd encountered in, mm-hmm, Lewis.
Yeah.
And he was from Brighton.
Yeah. I was an imposter. Imposter, I tell you. But the sad thing about the knock-on effect of that, I mean, my wife and I laughed about it, we told our families and whatever, but the knock-on effect of that, I think a little while after, I can't remember the name of the film, but there's a film about the first multi-racial couple, I believe, in England. Came out about a year later, I think.
That rings a bell, yeah.
And I really wanted to see it, but yeah, I was really scared.
Yeah.
I said... me as a black man going with my white wife, yeah, to go and watch it, people are going to look at us. I, yeah, now can't go and watch that film.
Yeah.
I'm going to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. I can understand. I can relate to that, and I can understand. I think, you know, there is more said about that, and I think there are quite a lot more awareness. You know, I love the fact that I walk around Lewis and I see people, you know, with stickers in their windows, you know, talking about Black Lives Matters, and in the past, you know, Lewis is quirky, and it has got there are good people around here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the place, and it's not, you know, having my young kids going to school, they don't know anything about their colour. They are happy as Larry in their school. There hasn't been any subject, you know, now and then maybe, but there isn't anything that makes them feel uncomfortable or bullied. You know, they go to a brilliant school and we all love it. But I think from this conversation, what I can take from, which what I have said all the time, is awareness. It's about familiarity. You know, none of my friends has ever talked about my colour, but none of my friends have also have had the need to maybe ask anything. Mm. Maybe they want wood, maybe they don't really see the need and they're familiar or they're not, but in one way or the other, it's about a conversation and the communication and being there to be able to explain and to be able to give people awareness of culture and diversity, because that is what makes a great country, that is what makes a great community, is that we can't all be the same. You know, not every child looks the same. There are people from different background, you know, in Lewis and around the county. And I think that's what makes us as beautiful. Mm. And, you know, what I take from this conversation is you are doing brilliant, brilliant, brilliant work in terms of obviously supporting youth in terms of, I mean, I know there are more to what you do than what we've touched briefly about, and maybe another time for those conversations. But, you know, I believe that, you know, having experience as a person who is of color and living in an area like Lewis grow and Sussex and growing, you know, through that and bringing children up and then dedicating your time to work in some challenging areas in around Sussex and supporting families and children. I think that's fantastic work and that I find that so interesting. And obviously you've shared some great experiences on how families and should be dealing with situations like that. And I believe and I hope that most of our listeners will take a really good a good piece from that. But it's been absolutely fantastic, obviously, having you on. You know, I'm hoping that we'll be able to get you back on again to talk a bit more about some of the interesting work you are looking to do for the future. But I will say last, you know, kind of words from yourself. I mean, how have you found this, Nick? Have you got anything else there?
No. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, been really interesting. Really, really good. Yeah, great.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both. I haven't got any interesting words that are going to be... I don't know. I think as I was coming here, I was thinking about stuff and what am I going to talk about and what's the overriding take home of what I want to talk about is that just we're all human. We're just all human. Treat each other like another human, no matter what they look like, who they love, who they want to be, how they dress, colour of the skin, you know, disability, ability. We're all just humans. We're all just moving forward. We're all just guiding each other. And that's all I'm doing. I'm guiding the younger people because I believe I've got something I can support them with. So just treat each other like all humans that are just guiding each other forward. Let's guide each other and be nice and... Yeah, I don't know, something like that.
Wonderful.
That's wonderful. Jason, you've been awesome, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Chalk It Up, and if you did, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with friends and family. You can also follow us on Instagram at Chalk It Up Sussex Podcast, where you can find exclusive content, including video footage of some of our shows. Thank you for listening.